seminar, but she, I'm happy to report that after having a rather brief and fragmented holiday last summer, she is now having 2 weeks in the California desert. And so we expect her back the end of this week, perhaps not a deep brown, but at least rested and relaxed. She will be back next Tuesday when Margaret Kivelson will talk on Beyond Sensory Perception, some concepts of modern physics for the non-specialist. Today we're especially glad to welcome Susan Talbis, whom we have not seen a great deal because she lives in New York, but she's up here for this week and perhaps a little longer, and it's very nice indeed to have her here today. Susan has said that she began her writing career with long epic poems in Hungarian.
At the age of five, yes.
And that she found a change of language a great stimulus to her writing. Well, as one who finds a change of language a great barrier to communication, even on the most elementary level, I was much impressed with this, and of course it also, since the change took place at the age of 11, I believe, it indicates a very early dedication to her writing. But she has combined with this what we would call a sound academic career as well, with a BA, with work at the Sorbonne, and a BA from Bryn Mawr, and her PhD from Radcliffe. Her fields have been literature and religion and philosophy. She's edited a collection of African myths and tales from 1956 to 63. She was a member of the Department of Religion at Columbia and curator of a special collection on religion and culture. She has written poetry and plays and short stories, and she's going to read to us today from her second novel, Lament for Julia.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I would like to read to you from a book I completed 3 years ago. Its title, while I was writing it, was Confession of a Ghost, less dignified but more humorous than Lament for Julia. I rejected it because I felt that the narrator of Julia's life should remain undefined and ambiguous, and somehow a vague appellation like ghost said too much. The book is written in the first person. The narrator is, in a sense, Julia herself, in a sense not. I hope you won't find this too disturbing. The book is in 7 parts. Prologue, in which the narrator mourns the loss of Julia and states his predicament in a number of ways, some unrelated, some contradictory. Part 2, Julia's childhood remembered. Part 3, Julia's adolescence remembered. Part 4, getting Julia married. Part 5, Julia married, a mother of 3 children. Part 6 gives several alternate versions of how the narrator lost Julia. And part 7 is an epilogue which brings us back to the prologue. I shall read a few pages from the prologue and 2 longer sections from parts 3 and 6 with bits in between. If I go too fast or if I'm incomprehensible, feel free to interrupt me. Just give me a little time to get started. Prologue. She's gone. Julia has left me. For good now, I think. She went silently under the cover of night. It was the only way she could leave without being followed. I think of her going out into the night, going out like a candle, going down, perhaps. I will never know where. I will never know how long ago. This used to be Julia's room. She left her skirts hanging in the closet. The many skirts I bought her, flared, pleated, and scalloped. I try them on one after another. Sometimes I wear several skirts at a time, skirts of different colors, full of her fragrance, her mysteries, skirts embroidered with butterflies, and little fishes flitting through seaweed. Her skirts subdue and appease me. Whenever I'm about to smash the windows or put fire to the house, her skirts rustling against my legs plead with me. Small, naked, and violent, I go sheltered under her gently swaying skirts. I'm dwindling, changing shape. I feel my bones grow soft, as if I were being boiled in a cauldron, then suddenly turned brittle. As I diminish, let her increase. We shall change roles. I no longer lord it over her, entangle her in my web, dangle her like a puppet. No, I'm old and dry, and she shall be my bride of freshness. She shall warm me like the 20 virgins swarming round old King Solomon. Or I will be her little child. I will cling to her skirts, better hide under them. She shall encompass me. I shall be diffused through her, annulled in her. No, she has taken them with her, the skirts, the beads, the fringed shawls, everything. This is no longer Julia's room. For years I have worked on her, trained her for one role than another, the hours we have spent trying on dresses, experimenting with different hairdos. Sometimes I wonder what she would be like left to herself. I try to remember her as she was when I found her, before I spoke to her, when she belonged to God. Oh, that blessed state. The calamity of our encounter whereby I usurped her being. Yet all my pains were taught preparing her for God. Why was she ever joined to me, oh miserable corruption, if I was not to restore her to innocence? Julia shall lie in the hands of God. She shall be a gift as gratuitous as a grasshopper, as justified as a blade of grass. But what about me? My clandestine labor, my ugly intrigues, how shall I be blotted out? No one shall know about me. No one suspect that we live together. It shall remain a secret between Julia and myself. And even Julia will be in the dark about our pact. I shall remain hidden behind Julia, invisible as the artist behind his work. More so, for my creation is not of wood or stone, but a living thing. I shall remain unknown, that Julia alone may be known. Julia, who was born a little child and chased down the green slope. Julia, who laughed at the moon when she lay down in the grass with her lover. It is she who shall stand before God's judgment seat, while I cover my face, metaphorically speaking, for I have no face. It is with Julia's face I cover myself. It is Julia's face that shall be bared to death. Julia, whom I want to be known, to be remembered, to be. Until I have put her on the ground perfect and entire, I remain unatoned. She sleeps, she drifts, she's absent. Past and future hold her dismembered in their many rooms. I shall use others to deliver her. Things and people, lovers, husband and children. She must have a brood of them. And because so much of her still remains captive, I will see to it that she shall have more lovers to discover her. I would have her opened like a fan, unraveled like a clue, exploded like a firecracker. I shall not relinquish any part of her. Yet how am I to understand my part in this grave farce? Shall I say I'm an intelligence of a sort? At times I fancied myself a celestial spark, a fallen angel, if you like, without, however, inquiring into the particulars as to whence fallen, how, or why, or fabulate on the celestial home of which I must still be a member. For if fallen, that crash has altogether blunted my memory. So trying to steer clear of that mythological bog, a spark, a gnat, a ghosting strand of thought, call it what you like, set, searching now for the most neutral metaphor, though at times it seems this consciousness has been struck in the flesh like a nail, or merely attached to the forehead like a miner's lamp, or planted like a seed to shoot root and branch, a creature within a creature, or perched on the shoulder like a chained hawk. Not the right image. Therefore, let us leave it at set, put, garrisoned in a body, and a woman's body it was to be to heighten the scandal. Cavernous, a thin partition wall of live membrane communicating with the wilderness, at moon times re-immersed in the sea of blood. My part, then, will appear in the course of the struggle as I exert a counterweight, hang on to the ledge while she storms and snaps and pounds about me like a rabid sea, keep my wits about me, counting each second of lucidity preserved of battle won. I shall improvise the other, by virtue of which she, who is eternally the same, shall be just that. I will be endlessly variable, assume contrary parts. Eventually I will disappear and leave her to her own devices, of which nothing will ever be known. Mine was a peculiar sense of accomplishment of the Japanese actor trained from earliest childhood to be a female impersonator. And the narrator continues with rather fragmentary flashes, mostly concerned with his relation to Julia when he began, when she began, and then looking for where the center of her life is so that her life may be told. I was there when Julia was born, suspended in the opal jelly of her eye, and so forth. I will not read more of the prologue, which ends with the narrator coming to an impasse, and he says, in the dark, I try to remember Julia.
Susan, may I interrupt just to be sure that people can hear back there?
Can you hear?
The acoustics in this small room are often very odd.
I pass to the beginning of part two. Have I made too much of Julia? How could I take her so seriously? Didn't her skirts, her graces, her soft ways gall on me? All this fuss about a mere girl. Yet how was I to judge whether to take her lightly or in earnest, not knowing how long, in what manner, and to what end we two were thus joined? The narrator raises the question of previous incarnations and concludes, but this does not help me now with Julia, for it is with Julia I have been charged. Charged myself, who shall say it was otherwise, yes, entirely on my own, without endorsement from on high, plunged into my self-appointed role, I braced myself against the void and made the leap into Julia. It was not quite like that. One must allow for time and the force of gravity. The lights are dimmed on the opening of that first scene. The curtain rises while the stage is still shrouded in darkness. Not until somewhere toward the end of the first act or the beginning of the second act did it dawn on me with a certain uneasiness that a play was going on. Was I at all aware of her existence? Faded snapshots of children squatting in the sandbox, tumbling over a snowbank. She was there among others. Her presence must have been a source of embarrassment, for I dimly recall trying to ignore Julia. I pretended I did not know her. When Julia's nose ran, I did not bother to wipe it. I looked out the window or up at the sky when they were talking about Julia. Perhaps I hoped that if I continued to take no notice of her, she would eventually disappear. Time passed. Julia stubbornly adhered. Shall I say she seduced me, moved me to compassion, or that I was flattered by her stubborn attachment to me? Because time came, I resigned myself to the fact of Julia, that I existed with and through Julia, mysteriously grafted on Julia, a parasite, if you will, on Julia. It will be said that I tried to make the best of a distasteful reality and gone too far. At the time, the task of mastering my new responsibilities was too demanding to allow me to perceive the absurdity of my situation. I became a child with Julia. There follows a description of the narrative's lives with Julia, the sort of worlds he invented for her, as well as the Klopps household where they actually lived. Father and Mother Klopps, whom Julia finds difficult to distinguish from the stuffed animals in the living room, a great uncle of Julia Klopps, it turns out, hunted wild game in Africa. Another, certain Gundolf Klopps, was a scholar and antiquarian. As for the parents, the suspicion is raised that they're not really parents, but grandparents. As for the parents, blotted out of memory, sometimes a generation is lost like that. I must pass over the several accounts of Julia's childhood, the romantic, the realistic, the narrator's struggle with Julia. He himself is painfully aware of inventing a great deal of this and of the untrustworthiness of his own memory, and remarks, says something like, her childhood then, the childhood I invented for her, if there's another, it comes through almost involuntarily. It's a snag in his fabric, a patch of another weave. I pass to part three, Julia's adolescence. I retrace the journey of the dark years, the lost years, the years Julia was changing into a woman. I mean the woman underneath the woman I foisted on her, the real Julia, or in this case, the not quite real Julia, but Julia nevertheless, for there were those long periods when I turned away from her and occupied myself with philosophy, left Julia to her stupid, harmless vices, window shopping, bubble baths, waiting for a true love to appear, paging through endless stacks of fashion magazines. Around Julia's 14th year, the narrator, somewhat overwhelmed by her entering into puberty, renounces all professional ambitions for her, and her destiny is to be a wife and a mother. Unfortunately, these are the war years. And I will read now a longer section from Julia's adolescence. Julia turned 15. 15 and still unbetrothed. How long would she remain in this larval state? I was impatient to have her unveiled, confirmed in her sex. Where would deliverance come from? The boys at school? A rowdy pack of pimply-faced pups. All my hopes were vested in some unknown soldier fighting on a distant battlefield. For him, I kept Julia chaste. I will not say that we were sorely tempted, yet I had reason to fear that Julia might commit a folly with someone outside her class. While ordinarily somewhat shy, Julia was alarmingly at ease and familiar with any delivery boy, plumber, or street cleaner. Perhaps she thought it didn't count. But I suspected a family trait. The Klopps, it is true, never discussed Grandmother Fuchs's promiscuities beyond remarking that she was prematurely oversexed, but I did recall rather spicy stories about a certain cousin Prudella, who was brought to childbed thrice by different butlers, not to mention our Aunt Etta, who, though she died a spinster, consoled herself with many a groom as well as his horse. Such deviations may be the privilege of a declining upper class, but I had better hopes for Julia. What was I there for, if not to save her from the Klopps' fate? Thus I doubled my guard in the presence of domestics, road workers, foreign laborers, and I must add, frail old men and boys of a still tender age. This office gave me, if nothing else, a sense of purpose. However the days dragged, and though our prospects remained dim, I could always boast of one accomplishment. I kept her a virgin. Living as we were in a loose age, where a girl might wonder whether her virginity was a prize to save for her husband, or a minor obtrusion she would do well to have removed at the first opportunity, I took a firm stand. Unsoiled, I would deliver her into her husband's hands. That Julia would marry a virgin bride was dogma. I will not deny, however, a powerful inclination toward more than one heresy, prompted, I must hasten to add, by the very sanctity encircling her virginal state. I simply couldn't imagine Julia's deflowering performed by her husband. The breaking of that sealed vessel called for an act of violence, brutal and illicit, free of any sentiment which might mitigate its quality of a pure transgression. The idea of being raped seemed, moreover, to appeal to Julia. Another favorite fantasy was that Julia sacrificed the flower of her youth to a nameless soldier. Not that Julia was a kind of girl to be dazzled by the flash of a golden button, the military belt, the holster. No. It was the impersonal hue of his uniform. When she yielded to him, she felt the fear of trenches, the desolation of the wounded and dying on battlefields. I was torn between the violence of rape and the tender gesture of offering, but I could not renounce my image of Julia as a virgin bride. Finally, I must confess my own secret fascination for prostitutes. A sneaking glance at one of those sad vampires was enough to plunge me in agitation. I never seriously considered it as a way for Julia, but for me. I could not pass one in a back street without a tremor of kinship. I was never so envious of the town's beauties as of their rouged pallor, their tawdry adornments, their look of an abused doll. On which altar would I offer Julia? There were so many gods. I would have needed as many Julias, one to be a whore, one to marry in white, another, no, at least a dozen little Julias to be raped in turn. Mere fantasies to pass the long winter afternoons and lonely evenings. That same year, her 15th year, Julia was deflowered. It happened on the night of the Christmas dance at the mayor's house. The ballroom was thronging with soldiers home for the holidays. Squeezed between steaming bodies, I held my ground, watching for Julia's reflection along the mirror-lined walls. I went prepared for an ordeal. It was a matter of obligation. How could I know if it wasn't Julia's chance to meet her man? After a while, I lost track. Dazed by the commotion of stamping feet, Julia yanked about, changing hands as a boy scut in, red-necked boys with perspiring palms. The next thing I knew, she was leaving the dance with a soldier. They crossed the road to his car. Should I have protested? But I was powerless. Oh, I have found out since. When Julia is alone with a man, she ceases to be my creature. It's as if she were launched. Without warning, the gangplank is raised. She sails, and I cower in the hold, a wretched stowaway. I recall a sense of mesmerized panic, clear as doom, as we were racing through the night, alone in a car, with some strange soldier called Bruno. I never caught his last name. At least she had been raped. If he had dragged her in the bushes and forced her against her will. But it did not happen so. She smiled when he unfastened her brooch. What shall I call it, then? A mere stupidity? Shall this blunder be entered in the book of life? Or can it be reconciled with my image of Julia? It was his last night before returning to the army post. It was not Bruno, it was a soldier. It was not Julia, but any girl in wartime. Julia wanted to be that anonymous girl. The details are irrelevant. Why do they intrude upon me in all their original oppressiveness? The moment Bruno asked her for a dance still makes my ears burn. Julia was just about to take a third round with a dogged and taciturn sailor when two gentlemen in uniform simultaneously requested her pleasure. It was a matter of a split-second decision. She looked from one to the other, both officers of the same rank, and passed the first flush of youth, the one big, bland, and beaming, the other small, fierce, and swarthy, hesitated an instant as the little man's eyes seemed to snap at her, but finally accepted the offer of the more generously proportioned suitor. I had a rather favorable impression of Bruno, even though he was baldish, and his volume was distributed in breadth rather than in height. No Prince Charming, to be sure, but agreeable, well-mannered, and a welcome relief from the raw youth Julia had been dancing with. When in the middle of the dance he suggested that they go somewhere else for a drink, I saw no objection to it. He would surely take her to one of the better places in town, and Julia, I thought, must feel enormously flattered to arouse more than the passing interest of a man who may have been in his early 30s and an officer, too. Not until he was already helping on her coat, did I reflect that by her leaving thus with Bruno, apparently to escape the stringy little officer, Julia, in fact, expressed a preference for him in favor of the other, and possibly a desire to be in his company in a more intimate manner than she originally intended. Their flight, moreover, was quite unnecessary, as the little officer with the snapping eyes was just then making his way to the cloakroom with his prize for the evening, a stately blonde leaning coyly on his arm. It is easy to say now that she should have backed out of it then. The moment Bruno helped her on with her coat, there scarcely seemed cause. He did not start the car immediately, but sighed and kissed the tips of her fingers and looked at her at length. Oh, what did that look mean? And why was he smiling at her so stupidly and pursing his lips like a baby as he whispered her name? Why whisper all of a sudden? Before they were alone in the car 5 minutes, it was clear that Bruno was afflicted with a most deadly passion for Julia. Before they had been driving another 5 minutes, it was clear furthermore that Bruno was not taking her to one of the cafes, but to the tavern where he was staying just outside of town. Wasn't that the moment for Julia to protest, demand that he take her to a cafe in town or straightway home? But how could Julia be cool and sensible when the man beside her was consumed in the flames of love, in a state of most pitiful agony induced, moreover, by her own radiant person? For while I cannot vouch for Julia's feelings for Bruno, I can say that the spectacle of Bruno's rapid deterioration swelled her vanity, besides engaging her compassion. Could she be so insensitive as to inquire about time or place or purpose when the man beside her was in so stricken a state, breathing hoarsely, stretching out his face toward her, his mouth hanging open and staring like a fish, a disgusting sight, no doubt. Yet could any woman be so callous as not to show pity on him? What does he ask for, after all? To clamp his lips on hers and stick his tongue in her mouth, squeeze her breasts, and yes, finally cuddle his whole member in her fold. For all her innocence, Julia knew where it would end. Yet how could she refuse to quench his thirst, especially since it was her irresistible charm that reduced him to this helpless state? Bruno had stopped the car before they reached the Trap Tavern, apparently incapable of steering while the fit was upon him. I flinched while he inflicted his suffocating kisses, wondering if the stringy little officer was using his companion in a similar fashion, and if it made the least difference in the world how the couples were matched that night. Was Julia looking to me to save her? But not at all. She had a bold air. She entered the tavern on Bruno's arm, poised as a queen, perhaps just a bit too exhilarated. Out with an officer, fancied herself quite an adventuress. The man's eyes hung with adoration on every visible detail of her person. He catered to her little whims. He was in her power, or so she thought. They had a drink in the tavern. Bruno ordered a bottle of wine and some fruit to be brought to his room. Now she was bought, caught. Up the stairs, Julia's courage began to falter. When she found herself alone in the room with Bruno, all of a sudden she could not speak for fear of bursting into tears. She bit her lip, strolled stiffly about the room, to the window, back to the table, absently examining the glass figurines on the mantelpiece. What happened? Her position changed suddenly from a conquering lady to a captive. After some amorous attentions and a glass of wine, Bruno excused himself and disappeared into the bathroom to prepare for the slaughter. Julia was at a loss. Did he expect her to undress? She slipped off her shoes, then put them on again, went to the mirror and tried to tidy her mussed crown, gave up, took out the pins, sat disconsolately on the edge of the bed, playing with her hair. Bruno came out of the bathroom in a pair of drawers. His torso, though not Apollonian, was firm, if shaped somewhat like a seal's. He leaned over her, exuding a strong compound of talcum and eau de cologne. Julia was on the verge of tears. He inquired if she was in her monthlies. Then Julia informed him, somewhat haltingly, that she was a virgin. Bruno's face melted. He reassured her that in just a little while that obstacle would be surmounted. In the course of the ensuing struggle, Bruno's expression altered. An air of professional competence replaced the lovesick looks. Perhaps he regretted the evening more than she. He would have preferred an experienced woman, but I want to be just. I was touched by the way he appraised her body before he actually fell upon her. My confusion from the moment of the assault was too great to be attentive to the details. I don't like to think of hands fumbling in the dark around those sacred precincts. In an instant of pure terror, Julia's body assumed the aspect of a fortress under siege, panic behind the walls. I became totally dislocated. Was I in Julia? Was I in Bruno? I was sick for days after from the physical shock alone. not to mention the shame. Julia, my virgin, was lost, wantonly thrown away. I despaired of her life ever attaining to coherence. What was there left? I turned to metaphysics, the only pure thing left in life. But this time my own voice mocked me. What? Search out the elements of being in a skirt? For a moment I was tempted to burn Julia's dresses, cut off her braids. But why seek congruity when I was made a monster? I would pursue my ends in this frilly masquerade. Keep vigil with Aristotle.